Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for the invite from everybody here at Perimeter. I've had a lot of fun so far. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about computability, complexity, and quantum phase transitions. It's going to be a combination of kind of like three different papers with various combinations of these beautiful people here down at the bottom. I thought I'd start with kind of like a very quick overview of what quantum phase transitions are and, you know, why you should care about them, and some technical definitions and details. I'm sure you guys are kind of mostly familiar with this. I feel like Perimeter, there are plenty of people who know about physics. And then followed by kind of three main results that I'm going to talk about, one of which is the uncomputability of phase transitions or phase diagrams, and then the complexity of phase diagrams for quote unquote realistic Hamiltonians, or maybe more realistic Hamiltonians. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about uncomputability and the renormalization group, or uncomputability and renormalization group methods. So hopefully everybody here is kind of familiar with thermal phase transitions, or kind of regular phase transitions, which happen at finite temperature. And these are phase transitions which are typically driven by temperature and some kind of some other kind of non-thermal variable, for example, pressure, magnetic field strength, composition. The classic being, you know, water, it melts to ice, it evaporates to steam. We're all familiar with this. And you can draw a very nice phase diagram that looks something like this. And as we vary temperature and as we vary pressure, we have different regions in parameter space where we take different phases of matter. Of course, temperature and pressure aren't the only things we can have. This is a phase diagram for is a bismuth tin alloy versus temperature. And as you vary the composition, you get different melting points and different phases of matter depending on composition and temperature. But you know, that's all classical physics. I'm a quantum physicist. I think classical physics is lame. So let's talk about quantum phase transitions. So, you know, a quantum phase transition happens at zero temperature. You know, it's driven by some non-thermal variable, for example, magnetic field strength. The kind of canonical example that people kind of use and use in textbooks is the 1D Ising model on a chain given by this Hamiltonian here. And it has, it turns out, a phase depending on the ratio of these two coefficients, J and mu. And the phase diagram looks something like this. So you can see if you have a really strong J coefficient, the spins preferentially couple to each other and they kind of ignore the magnetic field maybe. And so you get kind of the spins preferring to align with each other. However, you can imagine if I apply a really, 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 really strong magnetic field, all the spins prefer to align with the magnetic field. And so we get our spins aligned with the magnetic field. And there's a point between the two, you see here, where this is important to note that actually phase is an equilibrium property of a quantum system, and it's not related to the dynamics. So the phase doesn't actually happen very slowly in practice, but it still happens. And the quantum phase transitions are kind of enormously important for, you know, describing a huge number of very important phenomena that we're interested in, like superconductor, interstellar phase transitions, the quantum Hall effects, magnetic condensation, nuclear physical.
So as I was saying, this quantum phase transitions are responsible for a huge number of interesting physical phenomena that we like to explore and we want to understand. And it's kind of essential for understanding modern physics, or, you know, I'm going to tell you that it is, and you can believe me if you want to. So this leads to a very natural question, which is, how hard is it to compute the phase diagram of a Hamiltonian? I give you a description of a Hamiltonian. I want you to tell me where its superconducting phase is, where its other phases are, whatever they are. So far I've been kind of very hand-wavy about what a phase and a phase diagram and a quantum phase transition is, so I thought I'd define things a little bit more rigorously. I'm sure most of you will have seen some of these definitions before. So the kind of definition of a quantum phase transition that we're going to work with mostly today is this definition. So we say that a quantum phase transition occurs in a Hamiltonian, which is a function of one or many parameters phi, as a function of these non-thermal parameters, where there is a non-analytic change in the ground state energy as a function of that parameter. And it turns out that a necessary condition for this to occur is that there is a non-analytic, necessary condition for this non-analyticity is that the ground state and the first excited state energies suddenly coincide at a particular point. So this is saying that the spectral gap, the difference between the first and ground state energies, has to be zero at a particular point. So just as a kind of like cartoon schematic diagram, you can imagine that the energy levels of the Ising model that I talked about earlier look something like this. I have my ground state as I'm parameter G and my first excited state. And as I vary the couplings G, you can see that they converge and they cross. And the point at which they cross is the point where I get a quantum phase transition. And it's important to note that, strictly speaking, for everything, for things to be non-analytic, these quantum phase transitions only occur in the infinite limit. They only occur for infinitely large systems. But of course, you know, if I'm an experimentalist in a lab, often I don't have the ability to measure non-analyticities in ground states, because that's, you know, very difficult to measure. And so typically people work with things like order parameters or correlation functions. So a kind of typical definition is that a quantum phase transition occurs where there is a non-analyticity or a discontinuous change in some order parameter. And that order parameter could be magnetization, spin alignment, something else, something that kind of reflects the properties of the phase. So for example, in the water ice phase transition, people typically use density as a kind of order parameter. And typically we see that at a phase transition, there is a change in the connected correlation functions. We see that the phase transition typically corresponds with a divergence in the correlation length. So if I'm initially in a phase that has exponential decay of correlations, we usually see that as I approach phase transition, there's a divergence in the correlation length and the correlations start to decay algebraically. So a typical phase diagram might have correlation functions that look like this. I have two phases, which have exponential decay of correlations. And then as I approach this boundary, which distinguishes the two, and there's an algebraic decay of correlations along that boundary. So that's what I'm gonna say about the kind of like background of phase transitions. Are there kind of any questions? Or any comments or criticisms of what I've said so far? This is good. Also, feel free to ask questions. Oh, Dominic?
Why is the mathematical physics definition the right definition? So I come, you know, from the physics. I think of phase transitions as order parameters. How is that connected to energy?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when you're talking about phase transitions, what you're looking for is kind of like a drastic change in the properties of the Hamiltonian, or the state at zero temperature. And you can only really get that when, two eigenstates kind of cross, because that kind of corresponds to a kind of, well, that's the only way you can get a kind of drastic change of behaviors.
So why don't you talk about the spectral gap directly? Why do you talk about the energy?
So you can have closing of the spectral gap without a quantum phase transition. So if you have degenerate ground state. So that's actually not sufficient. Okay, cool. So the first result I'm going to talk about is uncomputability of phase diagrams. But to talk a little bit about uncomputability of phase diagrams, I need to tell you what I mean by uncomputability or undecidability. So I thought I'd give a quick review on that. So what does it mean for a problem or a computational problem to be uncomputable or undecidable? For the purposes of this talk, uncomputability and undecidability are going to be the same thing. Well, we say that a given computational problem, where I've defined it in some sense, a given problem is uncomputable if there exists no Turing machine or no algorithm running in finite time, which can correctly determine the outcome of every instance of the problem I'm interested in. And the classic kind of canonical example of this that people give is the halting problem. In this, I give you a description of a Turing machine, and I ask you whether or not this Turing machine halts or not. It's a pretty simple problem. I run it on some input, and I ask you whether this Turing machine halts. And it turns out this problem is undecidable, which implies that there is no algorithm running in finite time, which determines whether an arbitrary Turing machine or an arbitrary computational program will eventually halt when run. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say on uncomputability and undecidability. Does anybody want to throw in a question? Yeah, so one way I kind of think about this kind of intuitively is there's no logical procedure to determine the computational problem that I'm interested in. That's kind of the long and short of it. Okay, so now I've kind of told you that I'm going to talk about the uncomputability of phase diagrams. In order to kind of say something about computability or complexity or anything else, we need to define our kind of computational problem rigorously. So let's talk about the phase diagram problem. So the kind of basic intuition you want to think about is our computational problem is just going to be, I give you a Hamiltonian and tell me where its phase diagram, or tell me where its phase transitions happen, or tell me what its phase diagram looks like. But it's a little bit more subtle than that. We have to put some restrictions on the Hamiltonian we're talking about. In particular, as I said earlier, phase transitions only rigorously occur in the thermodynamic limit, so for infinitely large systems. So to restrict my computational problem so that I only input a finite amount of information, I have to specify my Hamiltonian to be translationally invariant, so the local interactions are the same everywhere. And as I'm sure you guys appreciate, this is a pretty natural constraint on the set of Hamiltonians that I'm interested in. I'm also going to insist that these local interaction terms, they only have algebraic numbers as matrix elements. The reason I want to do this is because if you input real numbers as matrix elements, I could theoretically input uncomputable numbers. And this is kind of cheating, because it's immediate that my local terms are uncomputable.
Do you really need algebraic, or could you just use rational?
Good question. Off the top of my head, I can't remember why it's algebraic rather than rational, because it does seem intuitively like you should just be able to use rational.
It's stronger with algebraic.
Yeah, maybe that's why.
Or computational numbers? No. Or computational
numbers? So computational numbers is another subtlety, which I think is to do with you can have uncomputable numbers. Why is that? In the actual proof, when there's a phase estimation procedure that you need to do, and it's not clear that it always works if you have computational numbers rather than algebra.
Like a pi.
Yeah, it's not totally clear that it always works. I mean, I think it should, but...
Can I ask a more naive question?
Sure, please do.
What do you mean by algebraic number?
Oh, so the numbers are roots of polynomials. There exists a polynomial with integer coefficients that you can solve, and this number is a root of that. Of that polynomial.
How important is it that it's algebraic? Like, they're dense in the real numbers, so it doesn't hold for real numbers.
Sorry?
Algebraic numbers are dense in real numbers.
Yeah. So the reason we're making this restriction is because if you take real numbers, you can theoretically have your matrix elements being uncomputable numbers, which is somehow allowing you to cheat somehow. So this is just a dense set, which is, you know, strictly computable and nicely behaved in some sense. So this is just going to, as whoever at the back said, this is kind of like a stronger constraint on what we're allowed to do. The kind of smaller set you can prove this for, the more interesting the result is. Any other questions?
Also, can we like define a phase transition without translation symmetry?
Yeah, good question. Not totally clear to me. Some people have tried. I'm not sure I totally believe their arguments. But I think you can always talk about, yeah, some kind of like interaction graph with uniform interactions over it.
So if we don't have translation symmetry, how to take the continuum or the thermodynamic limit? Is that possible?
I mean, you could theoretically just define your local interaction terms now with an algorithm, right? So they could vary in like a periodic manner or something as you expand your lattice. So here we're just saying we're restricting to a smaller subset. And we're also going to require that the Hamiltonian's matrix elements are going to be an analytic function of the parameter phi that we're going to vary. So this is going to be this parameter phi is going to be the parameter like magnetic field that we're varying. And we're insisting that our matrix elements are going to be an analytic function of that parameter. And our phase diagram problem is simply going to be I input a description of the local interaction terms satisfying these constraints. And I output the phase diagram as a function of the free parameter. Or alternatively, I output a point in the phase diagram as a function of the free parameter. So our result is the following. So we explicitly construct a Hamiltonian, H of phi, in 2D, on a 2D lattice with the following properties. The local interactions are translationally invariant and nearest neighbor interactions. And the local interactions are analytic functions of the parameter phi of this form. I also just appreciate that I've accidentally used two different versions of phi. Sorry about that. It's the same thing here. And the A and B here are matrices or matrices that have matrix elements that are either 0, 1, or 1 over root 2. So they're kind of nicely behaved matrices. And I'm going to promise you, or we can prove, that the system is in one of two phases. It's either in a critical phase with connected correlation functions which decay algebraically. It's a kind of highly quantum phase in some sense. Or it's like a classical product state phase where the connected correlation functions are zero. And in the thermodynamic limit, determining which phase the system is in as a function of phi is undecidable. So that's the result that we proved. I thought I'd talk a little bit more about it. So you can show that for this the system, the phase diagram has to look something a little bit like this. It has two phases, which I've noted in yellow and blue here. The yellow phase is the highly quantum phase with algebraic decay correlations. The blue phase is the very classical phase with zero correlation functions. And it turns out that this gray region, it's one of the two other phases, but just based on the model that we've constructed, it's very hard to tell which of the two phases it's in. So this is kind of unknown, but it's in one of the other two phases. And the phase diagram may look like something like this, or it may look like something completely different. And it turns out that this set of Hamiltonians, or determining what the phase diagram looks like, is uncomputable. More precisely, what we actually do is we show that there exists a Hamiltonian of the form described previously, such that in its phase diagram, there is a finite measure interval around each of the numbers in this set, such that the phase diagram in this, or the phase in this interval, depends on whether a universal Turing machine halts on an input k in unary. And we know that determining whether or not a Turing machine halts is an uncomputable problem. And since the halting problem is undecidable, determining the phase in these regions is uncomputable. And in particular, this means that determining whether the phase diagram looks like this, where phase transitions happen or where phase transitions don't happen, is an uncomputable problem. So a little bit more detail again, or just to remind you, this yellow phase that I've talked about is this highly entangled, has a highly entangled ground state. It's gapless, it's critical, it has algebraic decay correlations. The blue phase has a classical product state, it has spectral gap of at least a half, and has zero correlations everywhere. And the gray phase, or the gray region, is in one of the two other phases, but it's unknown.
There's two different yellows.
Yeah, that's an artifact of the projector. It keeps happening. I don't know why. The two yellows are the same. I don't know. It's a ticks image that kind of.
Sorry, by undecidable, you mean there's no finite time record to tell which phase you are in.
Exactly, yeah.
But I imagine if you can just brute force, or I don't know, put a DNRG calculation or.
That's a great question. And the RG stuff I'll come back to later. Brute force you can't do because it's not a finite size matrix. So if I take the thermodynamic limit of my Hamiltonian, that's an infinitely large matrix. I'm not sure. So there's no way of brute forcing this in some sense. But you're right, if I took a finite size Hamiltonian, I could theoretically just diagonalize this and look at what the ground state looks like.
Yeah, because I imagine you're a translation invariant, so that means I can just consider a two-point function and it should be simple to tell whether it's a constant or, whether it decays exponentially or like power efficient, right?
Sorry, say that. Why should I be able to tell if it's
if a transition? Consider some finite sizes, and then you can just compute a two-point function.
Yeah. You could just check. Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, David.
I feel like I've asked this before, but I don't remember the answer, so maybe I'll ask it. So, will you at some point comment on the relationship between this and the Knabe type bounds?
Yeah. So I can. I haven't in this in this presentation.
Does it place limits on those types of bounds for frustrated Hamiltonians, or is this frustration free? And I should think about.
So this is for a frustrated Hamiltonian, and this is saying that, or this particular construction is basically saying determining whether or not a so in the Knabe type construction, you have some kind of length scale at which it becomes apparent whether or not the Knabe bound is satisfied. This is, I think actually for these constructions, they do obey a Knabe type bound, but the size at which it starts obeying that bound is uncomputable.
Is there like a transition in the uncomputability? Like, can you tell if there is a sharp transition in the yellow and the gray regions? Like, do you know exactly where it will happen that it will become uncomputable?
So let's say if I take this part, this phase and this phase, I know that there is at least one phase transition between these two, but, and I, yeah.
I'm just thinking, did you draw, without knowing any details, like, do you know the boundary between gray and yellow, is that defined?
Gray and yellow, yes, yeah.
So you know exactly where it's going to be uncomfortable.
For this model, you can theoretically compute where a phase transition might be. So if I just, I actually haven't in this particular phase diagram have any regions where, so let's pretend this gray region is actually a blue region, and these two neighbor each other. So you are promised that there might be a phase, or you're promised that there are certain points at which a phase transition might happen, but determining whether or not a phase transition actually happens at that point is uncomputable.
Can you add if there is like one phase transition in the gray region, or there can be like uncountably many phase transitions?
In the gray region, you're testing my memory of the construction. I think there's promised to only be one phase transition. I think that's true. So if there is a phase transition, there's only one, but yeah.
So can I know that on the real axis, how many phase transitions can I have? It seems from the diagram that you can.
So for this construction, you're guaranteed that there are an infinite number of phase transitions.
Uncountably many, infinite or.
I actually don't know if it's uncomputable to determine the number of phase transitions. I think it probably is, but I don't know off the top of my head.
In the previous slide, since it was phi k and k was indexed from 0 to infinity, is it countable?
Oh, sorry, did you say uncountable or uncomputable?
Uncountable, sorry.
Oh, yeah, this is a countable number. Yes, you're right. Sorry, I heard uncomputable.
Sorry,
no, that's my bad.
You were saying that it is uncomputable to determine even the number of phase transitions.
Yes. But it is countable. It will be a countable number. Any other questions?
Do you know that it will be finite?
The number of what? The number of phase
transitions?
No. It's guaranteed to be infinite.
Okay.
So this construction.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. There's some body noise.
Yeah. For some sufficiently well-behaved condensed matter system, you would just say, well, I consider a large but finite size system, and that should be representative of the limits. Presumably that breaks down here, but how exactly does it break down? Like something very weird happens as you try to approach a thermodynamic limit?
Oh, disembodied voice, you have absolutely nailed what's going to happen I'm going to talk about in the next three slides. So I will answer your question then, if that's okay.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, and just to mention that the transitions between these regions satisfy any of the definitions or kind of signals of a phase transition that we talked about earlier. So once again, the phase diagram problem looks like this. You know, I have one of many possible phase diagrams, and I'm asking you to determine which of these phase diagrams occurs, and it turns out this is an uncomputable problem. Okay, so to the disembodied voice, this is the slide that you should be interested in. So what are the consequences of this, this construction? Well, the important point, or one of the most important points, is that the phase of this Hamiltonian at finite size doesn't tell us anything about the thermodynamic limit. So what we like to do when we do numerics is we like to take a small system, we like to diagonalize it or solve it by some method, and then we like to make claims that this reflects the thermodynamic limit. So what this is saying that, or what this particular Hamiltonian does is provide a counterexample where this is not true. And in particular, the addition of a single particle to the lattice can completely change the behavior of the Hamiltonian. And the size at which this occurs is uncomputable. So we cannot extrapolate physical properties from finite sizes. So just kind of maybe say that a bit more explicitly. So this Hamiltonian has the property that at size L times L, it might be in this kind of critical entangled state phase. But as soon as I move to L plus 1 times L plus 1 lattice, it changes to a gapped product state. And the size, or the L at which this occurs, is uncomputable. So whoever was on the Zoom call, does that answer your question?
I think so, thanks.
Awesome. And this means that in general, phase diagrams at finite size may not be reflective of the true properties of the Hamiltonian in the thermodynamic limit. So this is saying that this thing that we like to do in physics, where we like to take a small system and we like to diagonalize it, or we solve it using a renormalization group and we extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit, well, this can't generally work, which is a bit of a bummer. And it means, in general, we're not justified in doing numerics on finite size systems and extrapolating. But of course, you can ask the question, does this mean that we're ever, we can't ever rigorously calculate phase diagrams for any material ever? Oh, sorry, there are questions.
Sorry, and since you are mapping this to a healthy problem, you always know that whether a machine halts or not, but you cannot know whether a machine just keeps running forever. So in the previous slides, you have like two phases. One is like gap, one is like gapless. Which one looks more like the halt situation, and which one looks more like?
Yeah. So in the previous or in this particular construction, the gapped phase corresponds to. Oh God, I can't remember which one way around this is now. I think the gap phase corresponds to the halting case. This corresponds to the non-halting case. There are actually multiple different constructions of uncomputability in things like phases and spectral gaps, and they sometimes flip it around. So which phase corresponds to halting or non-halting isn't particularly meaningful in some sense, because both you can prove uncomputability both ways.
Although, like, just to push back, I mean, the Knabe thing does give a criterion for a gap in the thermodynamic limit from finite size, right?
Yeah. But the point is that the size at which you're guaranteed that this works from is uncomputable.
Right. But you can still do numerics on a finite size system and conclude that it's gapped. I mean.
Yes, you can.
Similar to like how you can check that a particular Turing machine halts on a.
Yeah. On a, if you take a like sufficiently large tape, you can just run it and see if it halts. Yeah, so that you are correct. I can maybe talk about this at the end, but I think there are counterexamples where you can take a sufficiently large system, and then you can basically show that a Knabe type bound can never hold. Nobody's proven that, but I think that maybe you can actually get away and you can just prove this.
Can you say what the Knabe type bound is?
Yeah, so the Knabe type bound is if you have a frustration-free system and you take a kind of expanding set of lattices, and provided the spectral gap, is it closes or opens sufficiently fast?
Well, actually, what you can do, I mean, one version is just like if you take a system of size like m for fixed n, and it's large, and the gap is larger than a constant over m, like fixed constant, like 6 for 1D, then you can conclude it's gapped in the thermodynamic. So from some fixed n, you can determine that it's gapped.
Yeah.
But that only works for a subclass of frustration-free models, and maybe these fall outside of that. That's why I was asking.
Yeah.
I don't mean to derail the whole
thing. No, it's a good question.
Okay, but the second question is, do you actually have an example where this happens?
Physics example, no. Or like, this is an explicit mathematical construction. You construct a Hamiltonian and take the limit, but like nobody.
But okay, so would you expect this to hold in, you know, realistic settings? Or is that just something very fine-tuned which you?
This is a good question. I don't know. This is a very interesting question. I can't tell you. There are some people who think that uncomputability occurs almost everywhere. Some people think it's a very rare constructed instances. It's a kind of ongoing debate.
Sorry. Just one question.
Sure.
What happens if you stay in the first phase and you make the couplings depend on a scale?
So you're saying you make the
non-local interaction instead of going bigger in size?
So you're asking, I don't think I quite understand the question. So you're saying that
the couplings that you're analyzing to check whether you are in one phase or another, what happens if they themselves depend on a scale, energy scale or?
An energy scale. That's a really good question. I don't know the answer. Nobody's proven anything. Can you say, you might do. I have no idea is the answer. Sorry. It's not a very satisfying answer. Okay, so yeah, going on to consequences, does this mean that we can't ever rigorously calculate phase diagrams for any material ever? That's not the case. But it does mean that if you want to kind of rigorously extrapolate from finite size systems outwards, you have to prove that you can. And indeed, there are examples of this. I've added in a work by David and Sergio Bravi, where they show, I think, for one-dimensional systems of qubits that are frustration-free, that you can determine the phase diagram. But in general, you need to go away and you need to prove this. So for molecules like water or some other kind of similar commonly found system, you're probably OK at making this kind of extrapolation. But for more complex and more interesting Hamiltonians, this very well might not be the case. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about, very quickly, the undecidability of spectral gap paper that some of you guys might not be familiar with or might be familiar with, which we build off. If you haven't heard of this paper at all, feel free to zone out for the next like 2 minutes. So this is a work in which they showed that there exists a set of Hamiltonians which are a function of some parameter phi, and the binary length of phi. And that this set of Hamiltonians have the following properties. Their nearest neighbor and translationally invariant, and determining the spectral gap is undecidable as a function of phi and its binary length. So you could argue, or you might be able to kind of very reasonably ask, you know, why doesn't this immediately imply uncomputability of phase diagrams? The reason is that this set of Hamiltonians doesn't actually have a phase diagram, and you can't even reasonably define what it means for this Hamiltonian to have a phase. They're kind of very weirdly constructed. And if you try to draw a phase diagram, you end up with a weird kind of set of measure zero points in a plane. And the reason for this is that the Hamiltonian's matrix elements are not analytic functions of phi, and so the ground state energy cannot be an analytic function of phi. And so this kind of definition of a phase diagram that we talked about earlier, or definition of a phase, kind of breaks down. So to kind of get an intuition of why this is the case, or why if you have non-analytic matrix elements, weird things can happen. If you just take this Ising model, but where I have a coupling strength phi, but I have a field that depends on the binary length of phi, you can see that as I vary phi smoothly, this can become almost arbitrarily large. And so I don't expect my ground state energy, or in fact any of my eigenvalues, to depend on phi in an analytic matter or an analytic way. So I thought I'd give a very, very brief overview of the construction. This is going to be very quick, so if you're not interested, feel free to zone out for a little bit. But the kind of nuts and bolts of this construction are this Feynman-Kidai of Hamiltonian from, I think, 2002. And the idea of this Hamiltonian is you can construct a local translationally invariant nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, which has a ground state which looks like what we call a history state. It's this. So this is just a, if I give you a evolution of a Turing machine or a quantum Turing machine, the ground state of this Hamiltonian is just a superposition of the state of this Turing machine at every time step. And what we do is we encode a Turing machine which runs phase estimation to extract a parameter phi, which we've encoded in the matrix elements of our Hamiltonian. And what we do is we run the Turing machine on input phi, and we apply an energy penalty to it when it halts. And this means that, an energy penalty opens up the spectral gap in the halting case and remains gapless in the non-halting case. And that's the kind of fundamental kind of part of this construction. It's not quite that easy because the gap decreases and you have to do a bunch of amplification things. So you have to change the phase estimation so it becomes approximate, so it introduces an error. To mitigate this, you need negative energy Hamiltonian. This puts the energy into a positive and negative pair. You have to combine this with a tiling construction, which looks something like this. Within the tiles and the squares, you have to encode a classical Turing machine, which corrects the energy using a negative energy Hamiltonian, which puts the energies into two different cases that I've written here. And then using this, you can show that Hamiltonian either has positive energy or goes to negative infinity. And you can combine this with other Hamiltonians to get a phase transition. It's a very complicated construction. Presenting it here is not going to give you any kind of meaningful insight into what it does. So I'm going to skip over it like that. And feel free to ask me at the end if you want more details. OK. So far what we've covered is that a quantum phase transition are phase transitions that happen at zero temperature. And they're associated with a non-analyticity in the ground state. And what we do is we explicitly construct a 2D Hamiltonian, which is a function of a single parameter phi with the following properties. It's translationally invariant, its nearest neighbor, it has a fixed local Hilbert space dimension, and determining the phase diagram is uncomputable. And this implies that the general problem of determining phase diagrams is also uncomputable. OK, so that's the first result I'm going to talk about today. Does anybody have any more questions about this?
Was the one you constructed earlier 2D?
Yes, it's on 2D lattice.
It had I and I plus 1.
You're talking about Feynman-Kidai?
Sorry, it had I and I plus 1?
Wasn't the example that you wrote had small h I plus 1?
Yeah, so it's just translation invariant along each of the axes. Sorry, it's just like a phi nearest neighbor coupling between two neighboring spins, and then phi the same coupling along those two spins, something like that.
Sorry, so is 2D spatial, or you can apply this construction to arbitrary?
You can apply it to arbitrary dimensions apart from 1D. We don't know how to prove this in 1D. Mm-hmm. OK, cool. So at this point, I'm going to talk a little bit more about more realistic Hamiltonians. So as various people have asked kind of throughout this talk so far, you know, these uncomputable Hamiltonians don't really act like the Hamiltonians that we see in nature. In particular, we expect that if I take a sufficiently large chunk of my material, then this sufficiently large chunk of material kind of acts like it does in the thermodynamic limit, right? And we also kind of don't expect our material to have an infinite number of phase transitions. This is kind of a weird property that, I don't know, doesn't seem totally legit. And yeah, we kind of, as I said, we expect the materials to act as if they're in the thermodynamic limit, which we have a sufficiently big chunk of material. And we expect the phase diagram to kind of be independent of size for a fixed set of values of parameters beyond some reasonably large system size. So the intuition, this is pretty simple. You know, if I take my block of ice, I take 1,000 blocks of ice, and I stick them together, I expect them to form a larger block of ice rather than to suddenly evaporate. That'd be super weird. Okay, so we can ask a very reasonable question. How hard is it to compute the phase diagram for Hamiltonians which satisfy this property? So I impose that for this set of Hamiltonians, the phase for a fixed set of parameters for all lattice sizes above some lattice size L naught, which is some polynomial in the description of the local Hamiltonian terms, is in the same phase for all those lattice sizes. And we're also going to promise that our set of Hamiltonians only has a single phase transition, or in the case where we have more than one parameters, it only has a single critical surface.
What is small n here?
Yeah, so small n, so when we're specifying this as a computational problem, we need something that scales. So n here is just the number of bits that we use to describe our local interaction terms.
Thank you.
All right.
Can you replace the polynomial economy and
without changing? It'll change the complexity class that it's contained in.
Yeah, but which class
are they into? Good question. It is. I think it might change. So we're going to see in a moment it's in P to the QMAX, but I think it'll probably change it to X space, I think. So in some sense, this kind of first condition, this is the set of Hamiltonians for which we can kind of reasonably justify doing numerics on, right? This is the set of systems which I can take a finite chunk of material, I can compute a guarantee that beyond this kind of reasonably large chunk, then the phase is the same for this set of, for a given set of parameters. And so I'm justified in taking kind of numerical extrapolations from finite size systems to infinitely large systems. And yeah, the kind of converse is true. Systems which do not satisfy this first property in some way can't be, or in some sense can't be studied, or can't be justified in studying using numerics. So we're going to justify, or we're going to phrase our computational problem, or we need to phrase this problem as a computational problem, which we call critical parameter. So it's the problem of determining where the critical parameter, or the critical value of our parameter is in the phase diagram. So we define it as following. Given a translationally invariant Hamiltonian with terms given here, satisfying all the conditions that we talked about previously and promising that it only has a single phase transition, then determine whether or not this critical parameter, where the phase transition occurs, is below some alpha or above some beta for alpha and beta separated by a constant. So the question is really, you know, I promise you that my Hamiltonian has one of two phase diagrams, either looks like this, or it looks like this. I want you to distinguish which case occurs. And it turns out that this problem is QMA X-pared and contained in P to the QMA X. And the proof is done by a reduction to the local Hamiltonian problem. So I'm guessing that a lot of you guys aren't familiar with QMA, QMA X, and Oracle classes in computation. He's smiling, so that tells me yes, he's not. So QMA is the class of problems that we can verify the solution to efficiently with a quantum computer. But we can't solve them efficiently, or we don't believe we can solve them efficiently. So QMAX is kind of an exponentially harder version of QMA. So this is just saying this is an exponentially harder problem. We need to run our quantum computer for even longer. And then P to the QMAX is the set of problems that we can solve if an oracle or some kind of like magic wizard gives us the answer or gives us solutions to QMAX problems. Okay, did that make some sense to people? Excellent. So there's a little bit of a, for people who are interested in complexity theory, there's a little bit of a kind of a gap between this QMA exp hardness and P to the QMA exp. I should also add, so QMA exp hard just means this problem is at least as hard as solving a QMA, or the kind of hardest QMA exp problem. So this is saying that this problem distinguishing between these two phase diagrams is intractable even for a quantum computer. As I was saying, there's a kind of complexity gap between these two, and you might be interested if we can somehow close that. So for a system where I only have a single parameter, phi, this is, we don't know how to do it, but if you allow me to have two parameters, theta and phi, I can define a kind of similar 2D version or two parameter version of this problem, in which I promise you that my phase diagram has one of these two phase diagrams, and I want you to tell me which of those two phase diagrams occurs from my Hamiltonian. And it turns out that determining this problem is P to the QMA exp complete. So it's slightly harder, or we can prove it's slightly harder. I thought I'd talk a tiny bit about the containment proof. So what we've done is we've taken a specific class of Hamiltonians, which satisfy this property that if I take a sufficiently large chunk of material, I can promise that its phase diagram at this finite size kind of reflects the phase diagram in the thermodynamic limit. But we know from the kind of previous section of this talk, this doesn't hold in general. So why can I make this claim for finite, or for this, why can I show that this problem of computing the phase diagram is suddenly computable for this restricted set of Hamiltonians? Well, the idea is from this property, this idea that I can take a sufficiently large but finite chunk of material. And what I do is I take this sufficiently large chunk of material at size L naught. And what I do is I just take this size, and basically I use an algorithm from Anderson Binus, and this allows me to estimate the spectral gap on this size of the lattice. You can think about this as basically I just diagonalize the Hamiltonian for this lattice size. And it turns out I can do this using poly-N queries to a QMA exp oracle. And then what I do is I do a kind of binary search in the parameter space of phi to determine where this critical point occurs. I can do this with poly-N queries to a QMA exp oracle. And so this problem is contained in QMA exp. Sorry, and P to the QMA exp. OK, so what are the consequences of this section of the talk? Well, the basic idea is that even for a translationally invariant nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, which satisfies this kind of finite size criteria, the idea that I can take a finite chunk of lattice and some computable size, and it reflects the phase in the thermodynamic limit. And this Hamiltonian only has a single phase transition. Even for this kind of very restricted class of Hamiltonians, determining the task of determining what the phase diagram looks like and determining where the critical points occur to an order one precision remains a computationally intractable task. So for general, kind of nicely behaved Hamiltonians in some sense, this problem remains intractable even for a quantum computer. OK, so that's all I'm going to talk about on this result.
So you gave us a proof of containment. What about the hardness?
Yeah, the hardness is, again, is quite difficult to talk about without being extremely confusing. The idea is you can reduce this problem of determining where the phase diagram is, or sorry, where the critical point of a Hamiltonian is in the phase diagram, to the problem of estimating an energy of another Hamiltonian. And you can show that there are Hamiltonians for which it's QMA exp hard to estimate that energy. And so because there's this kind of relation between the critical point of one set of Hamiltonians and the energy of another Hamiltonian, that estimating the critical point must be computationally intractable. The two parameter cases is reduced to a similar problem where I give you a Hamiltonian and now I ask you to determine the outcome or the expectation value of some measurement on the ground state or the low energy states of another Hamiltonian. And then that kind of determines where the phase transitions occur for that Hamiltonian. Okay, any other questions? Okay, cool. So the final part of this talk, I thought I'd talk a little bit about the relation between uncomputable Hamiltonians and the renormalization group. Or why doesn't the renormalization group work for these Hamiltonians? As I think it was you earlier, you asked me why can't we just apply the renormalization group? That's a great question. I get asked this at every talk I give. So we went away and we tried to understand why this doesn't work. So this is actually a slide. I often talk to computer scientists more than I talk to high-energy physicists and people. So this might be a very basic overview of the renormalization group with some kind of minor wrong details, but hopefully it's kind of broadly true. And so as I'm sure most of you are aware, renormalization group methods are these kind of like widely used kind of family of methods to determine things like phase diagrams, universality classes, and other properties when you're given a microscopic description of your Hamiltonian. And it's been enormously influential in 20th century physics. And the basic idea, or that we, the one that we like to use in condensed matter physics, is we like to apply some iterative process to our Hamiltonian, which removes degrees of freedom while simultaneously preserving macroscopic properties, or kind of important physical properties. And this generates a flow in the parameter space of Hamiltonians. And this flow, or how the Hamiltonians flow in this parameter space, tells us a little bit about the physics of the system. So kind of very heuristically, we take our initial Hamiltonian, we apply a renormalization group process, we end up with a slightly simpler Hamiltonian, we apply the RG mapping again, we apply a lot of times, and eventually we converge, or we hope we converge, to a fixed point of a Hamiltonian H-star. And ideally, this Hamiltonian H-star is in some sense simple enough that we can straightforwardly extract physical properties about it. And everywhere along this kind of mapping, we're in some sense preserving some important physical properties, such that this simple Hamiltonian in some way reflects the properties of the more complex Hamiltonian that we initially started with. So this is kind of maybe best explained with, just an example. So, something that you'll see in all the textbooks is the 2D Ising model, just given here, where you have two parameters, J and B, and we're going to consider it at finite temperature, beta. And if you'll excuse my absolutely kind of like childish diagram that I've drawn here, one kind of RG mapping that you might think of applying is I take blocks of 2x2 blocks of spins on my lattice. And what I do is I just take kind of a majority vote of what the spins look like. And then I replace every block with a single spin, depending on what the majority vote was. So I end up with a new Hamiltonian, now defined on kind of superspins. But I'm also going to insist that the partition function is preserved or approximately preserved under this mapping. And this defines a new set of parameters, J prime, B prime, and beta prime. And then what I can do is I can do the same process. I block groups of spins together. I end up with a hyperspin or a super superspin. And because I'm insisting that the partition function is approximately preserved during this mapping, I end up with a new set of parameters, beta prime, J double prime, B double prime. And if I repeatedly apply this mapping where I take majority vote, I end up with a flow of Hamiltonians in kind of parameter space. And it turns out that if I choose my my initial Hamiltonian to be in a parameter space which is above this line here, I'll see that they flow to a crit or a fixed point corresponding to infinite temperature and zero coupling strength. If I choose it below this line, it turns out that the Hamiltonians will flow to a infinite coupling strength limit with zero temperature. So if we just look at these fixed points, we see that this corresponds to a totally disordered system, has infinite temperature and no coupling strength, whereas here corresponds to infinite coupling strength and zero temperature. So this is a highly ordered phase. And so this means that this line here, which distinguishes these two kind of basins of attraction, has to correspond to the phase transition between these, or the phase transition that occurs in this Hamiltonian. And the reason is because I promised you that the partition function, or kind of like the important properties of my Hamiltonian, are preserved by my renormalization group map. If this corresponds to a disordered phase, then the Hamiltonian here must also correspond to a disordered phase. If it corresponds to an ordered phase down here, then the Hamiltonian here must also correspond to an ordered phase. Okay, so that's a super duper hand-wavy summary of the renormalization group. So this is just saying, this corresponds to a totally disordered system, as I was saying earlier. Okay. So we talked a little bit about these uncomputable Hamiltonians earlier. And the uncomputability of the phase diagram means that these renormalization group methods necessarily have to fail, right? a renormalization group mapping is a computable procedure. And if I could solve phase diagram using renormalization group mapping, there'd be some sort of contradiction. What's also interesting about this problem is we kind of expect fundamental theories to be renormalizable. So if no renormalization group method can exist for uncomputable systems in some sense, it might suggest that kind of these fundamental theories are in some sense uncomputable, which in some sense cannot be uncomputable, which I think would be an interesting result. So why do these renormalization group methods, or why do renormalization group methods fail on the uncomputable Hamiltonians we saw earlier? Well, potentially there's no way of constructing a renormalization group procedure for these uncomputable Hamiltonians. Or maybe any procedure that we can construct has to fail in some sense. Maybe it fails to preserve key properties, such as the spectral gap, or other key properties that we might be interested in. And in a work I did with some others, we proved the following theorem. It is possible to explicitly construct a renormalization group scheme for the uncomputable Hamiltonian that we saw previously, such that each step of the RG scheme is computable, and all the properties reflecting the kind of phase of matter are preserved, such as the spectral gap, or the order parameters, or the correlation functions. And the Hamiltonian flows to one of two fixed points. It flows to a gapless fixed point or a gapped fixed point, depending on the phase. And the overall flow of the Hamiltonian, or sorry, the overall renormalization group flow is uncomputable. And determining which fixed point it flows to, it's undecidable. So you can see, or what happens, if you try and look at the Hamiltonian flow in parameter space, so this is the number of iterations of my RG map. This is a particular parameter that I've singled out. If I choose two Hamiltonians, which are initially very close together, what you'll see is that initially, they'll start flowing together. And they'll flow together continuously. And then at some point, one of the Hamiltonians may jump and converge to the other fixed point. And whether or not this jump occurs, and where this jump occurs if it does occur, are uncomputable properties. So what we're saying is that the renormalization group mapping is well-defined, but its behavior in parameter space is uncomputable. We don't expect to be able to predict it.
Is this related in any way to classical chaos?
Yeah, really good question. No. The reason it's not is, I guess, I view chaos as, I give you some chaotic system, and I can try and predict the behavior of this system based on some initial points. But the system is so sensitive to the initial data that I can't predict it at long terms. This is slightly different. This is saying, even if I give you the exact description of the initial conditions, then I cannot predict its dynamics at further times. So chaotic systems I view as, if I had the exact initial conditions, I could theoretically predict the trajectory of the flow in parameter space. This is different. This is saying, even if you do have the exact conditions, you still can't predict the flow in parameter space. So maybe it is related, but it's not the same, if that's what you're asking. Any other questions? OK, cool. And so this is to say that good, well-formed renormalization group schemes do exist for uncomputable Hamiltonians, but they flow in an uncomputable manner. And this is a kind of a new and previously unseen behavior. And although we constructed a specific renormalization group scheme for our uncomputable Hamiltonians, we expect this behavior to be generic for any good renormalization group scheme applied to uncomputable Hamiltonians. I've misspelled Hamiltonians there. OK, so overall summary of the talk. Determining phase diagrams is maybe surprisingly an uncomputable task. And even for Hamiltonians with natural properties, with these kind of finite size conditions, it remains a computationally intractable task, even for quantum computers. And we've seen that renormalization group methods have to fail on these uncomputable Hamiltonians. But in the process in which they fail, they show this kind of novel, unseen, and I think quite interesting behavior. So that's all I'm going to say today. I'm going to leave you with a bunch of further questions. Feel free to ask me about them. Thank you very much.
Okay. I have a question. So it's very unrelated to your talk, but so you showed us it's difficult to find out where the transition point is. What about the existence of different phases? Is that also a difficult
point? So you're saying if I give you a Hamiltonian, just determine whether or not there is a phase transition at all?
Yeah.
I think that probably is also uncomputable. Actually, I think it actually may be even harder than uncomputable. I think it might be the next class up in the arithmetic hierarchy.
What is harder than uncomputable?
Yeah, really good question. So you can define classes based on kind of oracle queries. So suppose you have some wizard who can answer uncomputable problems. You can ask him questions, and you can determine, or you can talk about the set of problems you can solve when you have access to this oracle. Or you can think of it in another way, where you have kind of, this is a computer science definition, where you have different existential quantifiers in terms of the problem that you're given. And that changes, you know, how hard a problem is to show.
Any question from Zoom? Okay, I have another question. Do you expect there is a kind of similar harness for approximation? Like, if I guarantee that the gap is either zero or like larger than something, and then like if you like, I'm asking some kind of PDP version for this.
Yeah. So actually, we do prove that. So we say the gap is either a half or it's zero, and distinguishing between those two is.
If I guarantee that the gap is bigger than some given number.
Some given number.
Yeah, or like the difficulty, like the entry difficulty, bigger than some given number.
I don't understand how that's different in this case.
Like the gap is the energy of the whole system. Like the if I want to determine what the energy density is, although finite.
But the energy density is also finite.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you want to find out whether the energy density is also finite, as in like greater than zero, this is. This is uncomputable, but yeah, approximating this, I think, becomes computable. So if you just ask for an approximation to some finite degree, I think this suddenly becomes computable.
Oh, okay.
I think that's true, yeah.
Like the PCP
version. Yeah, I don't think there's a PCP version for, it's not totally clear to me. This is for thermodynamic systems and thermodynamic limit. Yeah.
Yeah. The density.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.